All right. Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. With my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technological discovery you should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by my anonymous friend Lau. He's been a small business owner since he started working and has always been interested in getting the best value for his time with the least compromise. After he managed to own his own time, he started dedicating it to studying Bitcoin, socialism, and Austrian economics to try and understand where we all might be going in the future. I've already had many wonderful conversations with him in real life, and I'm happy to welcome him finally, I might say, on the podcast. So welcome, Lau.
Thank you, Bram.
We're here. Yeah, we start in Dutch. Well, yeah, like I said, I think we had lots of nice conversations. We knew each other a bit from the internet and then we met in real life. And I think, I don't know, first time we met, we talked for 3 hours or something about everything, I might say. So I'm super excited to jump in. You sent me some thoughts and statements before our recording about economy, philosophy, your insights in life and Bitcoin. So I'd love to just go through them together in this episode. And I wanted to start with what your definition is of a paradigm and why you believe they are essential for exploring ideas, despite some of them not being true, right? I think that's a big thing in Bitcoin is I think you can factually learn how Bitcoin works. You know, that is all out there. All that information is out there. But actually switching the paradigm that you adhere to consciously or unconsciously, like that's the biggest challenge for people. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think a paradigm is a structure that we can use in different ways. I think we can use it to understand a certain situation and how it develops. And it is, I think, essential to understanding certain situations in life and how they relate to one another. And I see it as a framework and a construct that we are capable of creating that doesn't necessarily need to be true, that we can use as a tool for reaching ideas and insights that are helpful for discovering truth, discovering how things could be. And sometimes you just need to sidestep truth to see what isn't true so that you can determine where to go with your mind. And I think a paradigm is very helpful in this sense.
But you would agree that they are all created, right?
I mean, I
actually wanted to ask, what is truth, right? What is? How do we know what is true? Isn't that always subjective in a sense?
Not necessarily. It depends on what you start with as the basis of what we are as humans and what knowledge really is. We can go very deep and philosophical into whether a thought or an idea really exists if humans don't exist, but given the situation that we're already talking to each other, I think it's safe to assume that that thought is not necessary for discovering knowledge, discovering understanding. And so a paradigm is a construct. It's a framework that is designed by people, by thinking about thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the danger there is that a paradigm becomes an ideology, right? I mean, if we look at how, you know, for the dimension of economics that touches Bitcoin. We live in a world where there's not really a challenge of the paradigm, the economic paradigm that we live in, right? And for lots of people that lead economics in our world, it became more of an ideology than a continuous kind of like exploration of how can we improve, right? So I think you mentioned something like ideologies are becoming redundant. How do you put that in, you know, view on economics, and then, you know, especially your angle comes from Austrian economics. Can you share a bit about that?
I think to use Austrian economics as a way to describe economics, you're looking for an epistemological basis for every thought you have about it. You want to at least verify with logic whatever you find to be true, and then incorporate it in how you can describe what economy is. And I think Ludwig von Mises explains this perfectly in his book Human Action. And I think if you don't do this, then you create an ideology. And an ideology is something that is per definition not necessarily true. It actually requires some fiction. Otherwise, it isn't ideology. But the danger isn't in there being an ideology. The danger is in basing the outcome, the goal of your understanding, what you're looking for, basing it on an ideology, because that becomes a bias then for whatever happens after that. And I think this is what happened to modern economics, and just neglecting research done by other economists. And I think by that becoming an ideology, and then claiming it isn't, also didn't really help achieving any real understanding of the actual reality that economy is.
Hey there, thanks so much for listening to this episode. I just really want to ask you for a quick favor. Over the last few months, I've seen that only 75% of people who listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube are actually subscribed. The most important thing I'm currently focusing on, next to hopefully giving you interesting conversations, is growing this podcast subscriber base so I can continue with it into the future. I want to thank everyone who has been viewing and listening to Bitcoin for Millennials, leaving comments here and sending me DMs. It's been super, super motivating. So thank you so much. So I really want to ask you to please hit the subscribe button on YouTube or follow me on your favorite podcasting app if you are enjoying this podcast. Thanks again for joining me on this journey. Now back to the conversation. Yeah, but like where we live in now, you see that based on certain ideology around economics, certain policy is created, I would agree, in a biased way, right? They write the policy to eventually achieve, you know, basically only the one goal of the ideology they follow. But you've stated before, and I love that like, and I think that's from Mises too, right, about human action, that human action always adjusts and continues regardless of the policy, right? So these ideologues, they create policy to influence human behavior. But you state that the people will always find a way around it. And how, like, I wanted to ask you, like, how do you see that in the current state of economics? Like, when, now that I'm saying this, I'm thinking about stuff like prohibition, you know, that's maybe a bit more classic, right? But there's always people that do not adjust their behavior based on a certain rule, and there's people that do. So why Why do you think there will always be more people that will actually not adjust, that the human action actually always trumps the policies?
I think it's just because human action is a phenomenon. And if you change the conditions for that phenomenon, it doesn't change the phenomenon itself. It changes the outcome of it. So if you forbid somebody to do something, then they're going to look for a way to achieve a better situation for themselves in a different way. And they're going to look for the thing that isn't forbidden anymore, or they're going to risk the crime. And that's what you see in the war on drugs, for example. People take drugs. There's no way to stop people from taking drugs. One in four people in the United States uses cocaine. It's a given fact. And they will use cocaine no matter what the punishment is. Having a policy like a ban on drugs, I think it's idiotic, because you don't change anything about the desire of people and the economic choices that they make. What you do create is a system that allows criminality to exist. If you want to get rid of the criminality, then you have to accept the fact that people take drugs and they desire to do so no matter what. And I see even easier policy, and that is to make money on drugs. The United States could potentially make a lot of money on taxing the industry, but they don't. They spent a lot of public money on the war on drugs, and it's just all wasted.
So why don't more people think like this? I'm thinking about, you explained the paradigm, like lots of people live in a paradigm, or they follow a paradigm, right? That kind of helps them structure their life and actions, etc. I think, you know, if people listen to this now and they hear you say, well, people just use drugs, right? And I can imagine some people say, yeah, but drugs are bad, okay, you know, like that. But it's interesting because I feel that, for example, with this topic, right, you can feel like multiple things are true at the same time, right? Like, I agree, human action will never go away, right? Like the need of people to do what they, or the want of people to do what they want to do, or circumvent certain rules created by just other people. Right? Like, why would these other people know better than me what to do with my life? Like, I agree with that. But also, I do agree with, for example, in the, let's say, the drugs topic, right? If you completely legalize drugs, there will be more people that do drugs, and not everyone should do drugs, you know, like whatever drugs you're talking about.
But do we know that for sure?
I mean, that's a good reply. I mean, more like, I don't know, kind of following this idea of like, the fact that you can doesn't mean you should, or something, right? Like, and it kind of ties into how
there are more side effects.
How can you
of the war on drugs? So, for example, illegal street drugs create a situation where somebody goes looking for weed, and they go to a street dealer. The street dealer doesn't only have weed in his pocket; he also has some fentanyl, he also has some Oxycontin, he also has some GHB. Whatever the dealer carries is for sale, and people who are tempted to try different things will eventually try it sooner under the influence of an illegal dealer who is just there to scam them out of money. I mean, the ethics of a street dealer is pretty questionable. So the side effect of street dealing is hazardous to the user of the drugs. And this is one of the reasons that in the late 70s and early 80s in the Netherlands, coffee shops became allowed. And this is because the guys who went to Nepal and came back with a big slap of hash, they also had heroin, and it kind of looks the same. So they would just sell it in the streets to whoever wanted to buy it. And this is how heroin became popular as a drug, as a recreational drug in those days. And there were dealers who did have an idea how to conduct this more safely, and they just started talking with the governing bodies about potentially creating shops that would just sell weed, because weed is sort of harmless, and hashish, and because it's just THC and some CBD, and it's not as impactful on your health and on your mental health and your further productivity as heroin is. So the course that the Dutch government took with that, by allowing it and working together with people who sell drugs to at least allow weed and hashish, I think is a very sane reaction to the availability of several kinds of drugs that had extremely different outcomes on behavior of people. I think people aren't looking to use heroin per se, but if they are tempted to, then there is a higher chance of them actually trying it. And of course, it's pretty addictive. So,
yeah, I'm thinking about where to go with this. I think I started this with, like, you know, multiple things can be true, because now that you're talking, I think about, you know, like, of course, alcohol is legalized, and I mean, we could have a conversation about that. Alcohol is probably worse than smoking weed from time to time, right? But it's just so normalized that you know, and there's a lobby, of course. So if there would be like a complete legalization of drugs, there would be some sort of lobby fight with the alcohol industry and tobacco for sure. So and as you said, like, not people are not necessarily looking for heroin, etc. But I feel like it's kind of, and that's why I talked about the paradigm part. Like you just said in the beginning, you know, paradigms are essential for exploring ideas, right? But if you want to explore ideas, doesn't mean you can, right? Like you have to be able to open your mind to a certain degree, and park some of the thoughts or the beliefs you have in order to also explore new ideas, right? And in my opinion, that's a very conscious action, right? You consciously search for things that challenge your beliefs and thoughts to see what you can learn from that. And I think that not everyone can do that, which is okay, right? But then, you know, if you would open up for example, like all the drugs to just be bought legally, that's kind of my point more. Like, I don't think everyone can actually be responsible, but perhaps this is also something we touch upon later. But I feel like it's kind of, you know, the taking the responsibility to consciously think about, what do I spend my time on, or what drugs do I want to take, or which book do I want to read? I don't think that's very different from each other. Does that make sense? Like, mm-hmm. what you do, basically, what you spend your time on, or what action you take. So that's why I said, like, multiple things can be true at the same time. Like, I agree with less policy and let people just do it. But there are people that cannot handle that responsibility.
Well, I think in understanding human action, what that means is you have to make the decision to you have to make the sane decision to stick to sanity, and to understand that if you want to implement a policy, you need also to have you have to create a policy that is enforceable. Implement a policy that isn't enforceable. It's just not. It's insane. Hmm. So as soon as you discover that something is not enforceable, you need to stop with the policy, and then you need to figure something else out. And you can find something. Maybe there is a policy with drugs that does work, but prohibition in this case has turned out to be a complete disaster. I mean, an utter disaster. All my American friends, everybody I know in the States, and this is hundreds of people, out of everybody they know, there are people who died from overdoses. Mm-hmm. And for me as a Dutch guy, this is unheard of. I don't know anybody in the Netherlands who has OD'd on anything at all.
I agree. Me neither. No. Yeah.
So it's just complete nuts.
Yeah. I think that's a great illustration, by the way, where, I mean, I think the drug laws in the Netherlands are flawed, right? It's like a real Dutch solution to this, like how they approach it now. But it's still better than total crackdown on it. I agree. That's already what you see with this illustration of, do you know anyone who OD'd and died? Like, yeah, I don't know anyone either. So I think that's a fair point. So when you talk about, or when people in Bitcoin especially, you know, talk about Austrian economics, how does the approach in Austrian economics help us in understanding like those limitations of policy that you just mentioned? I mean, you read way more about this than I did, but I'd love to get like an insight on how does Austrian economics approach this specific part.
Well, it explains a lot about what is going wrong, and it also explains how to fix it. But that's only through a hard money standard. And that's the reason why I became so interested in it. I got bitten by the Bitcoin bug hard, as many of us were, and I thought there has to be some way to understand more about the consequences of Bitcoin. And I think much good has been said about this. I've recently read Knut Svanholm's Praxeology. It was a really good book. It's a very, very good introduction to human action, praxeology, human action. But I think not many people who own Bitcoin currently are aware of the topic and the broader consequences of it, how the incentives of people change on a different money standard, and it is being hammered on constantly. But I still think, by the way people react to one another on Nostr, for example, in exchange of messages, there's still too much sticking to the old mentality of having a high time preference and not understanding that you can now finally let go.
So what's the core of that, you'd say? Like, what's the thing that people don't understand then yet?
I think that they're still selling their time. And because they're still selling their time in a way that is eroded by the system that's paying them out, they don't open their eyes for the thing they should be really doing. And many are doing it, or halfway doing it, or for 90% doing it, but still lots of the old paradigm lingers in the minds of many Bitcoiners still. And I think it's just a matter of time that this just evolves towards a better understanding of how to spend time efficiently and how to really master time preference to make better.
That's what I actually wanted to say. I think if you would want more people to move into this harder money, right, quicker, then that is, of course, a sign of high time preference, right? We cannot, I think this is an interesting subject because I think, especially on Twitter, and I know Twitter, especially for us or Noster, you know, it's a real bubble. We are at the forefront of this new thing, but I feel lots of people expect way too much in way too little time, right? They want so many things to happen in a short period of time. Right, their expectations are way too high, and I think we cannot expect people to move to this new money very quickly in whatever way, right? Like whether you sell your fiat currency for Bitcoin, or you start taking a job in Bitcoin, or selling your products or services in Bitcoin, whatever that is for someone, right? It just takes time. And I don't know how that is for you, but I feel like that is also part of the personal challenge for us. Like we already see this and we want this to exist. And we know that the world on a hard money will become super abundant. And people will actually do what they would love to do, right? In terms of job or ventures or whatever. But it just doesn't change this fast because the paradigm that we're battling, right, is very strong. And most people don't actually realize that they are operating in a certain system that they just don't understand. So, yeah, I just feel like we should also temper our own time preference in that sense.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also because, well, even though Bitcoiners focus on the cyclical nature of Bitcoin all the time, they just do it to watch price action. And all the models are about price action. And I think price action is interesting because it shows what you then can do with it. And I think the cyclical nature of Bitcoin that I'm now mostly interested in is what capital is freed by the price action of Bitcoin. So with every cycle, the price goes up, and then the budget of people, us Bitcoiners, becomes enormous. So imagine going from having invested 100,000 in Bitcoin a couple years ago, and then by that owning 20 Bitcoin. You now have more than 20. You have now more than 10 times as much. And all this money is now giving you a feeling of safety. And you're just smiling all day. And this is real capital. It's real money. This is not something that you became owner of because you leveraged into debt. So it's not like you own 20 houses and only a percentage of that is yours. And your stream of income pays somebody else's stream of income. No, this is Bitcoin. It's true. It's hardness, and it's in your possession, and you can do with it what you want. But now fast forward another cycle, and it 10x'd again. Then all of a sudden, your lifestyle changes because you now no longer need to work. You have 15 million. And you don't know what to spend it on, but you do have ideals. You're not an ideologue. You have come to see that Bitcoin really works. You're an idealist. You understand the value propositions of Bitcoin, and now with that, you can also invest back into Bitcoin, and you have every incentive to do so. And what is your budget? It's literally the magic internet money. And yeah. now, because you have $15 million, you have $5 million to spend without mm-hmm. there a need to be a return, because the return is already in the Bitcoin that you have. It's already that valuable. So this happens every cycle. And the people who are in Bitcoin now and have been for a long time, they have every incentive to invest back into Bitcoin. You see this with Jeff Booth coming to the realization that he is holding on to something which is not just an idea, not just the wealth that it brought, but it's a holistic thing too. Bitcoin gave him a certain freedom, and he wants to give back to the community also. And yeah. you see that he starts to spend his time in a certain way, so that, as he calls it himself, he is no longer a hypocrite. He is contributing to the development of Bitcoin in the way he thinks is best. And when we were at Bitcoin Atlantis in Madeira, we saw Michael Saylor in his speech, and he announced there to the public that MicroStrategy is no longer just a Bitcoin investment company. It's a Bitcoin development company. And the reason that he says this is that he has every incentive to invest capital into Bitcoin development, because the more he makes the ecosystem, the more value he creates for the ecosystem, the more it also returns to the value that he holds. Yeah. So a certain fall off percentage of acquired wealth can go to just distributing it to people who are building for him, creating a better ecosystem, and he doesn't even need to own it, because everything that happens in the ecosystem is better for him. So he's every incentive to give a loan to a certain small company, a startup that is developing eCash on Bitcoin, or a new kind of wallet that does something that is just more seamless in integration, or whatever you can think of, or a mining company for that matter.
Yeah, I think there's also a really big shift in, you know, a fiat economy or a fiat world is kind of like a zero sum game, right? When I win, you lose. And a Bitcoin world is a mutually beneficial game, basically. So exactly like you said, right? Like
we both win.
We both play. Yeah, exactly. And that's also sometimes what I see when I try to like pierce through like negative views on Bitcoin, right? People think it's too good to be true, basically, right? Like that they, in a sense, can save themselves, right? Or actually build towards the future, or be that lucky that we are living at this moment and in time where a new money is being monetized. That, you know, that can actually be given to you in some sense, right? And I think I talked about this a lot before, but I think the conversation I had with Eric Kaysen really stands out. Like, it's a very nihilistic worldview, right? The zero sum game type thing, like mm-hmm. It's very negative, like very, very, very negative. And also, it doesn't give people, of course, because it's nihilistic, but like a positive outlook on the future. To be honest, I don't know a lot of people, especially outside of the Bitcoiners I know, that have a really positive outlook on the future. You know, like, it's pretty nihilistic. I shared this, I think, a few episodes back, but like, I talked to a guy our age, super smart guy, CTO of a company. And he totally understood like all the flaws of fiat money, understands how Bitcoin works, but he still thinks it's not going to work. you know, because it will be corrupted or whatever. And then I asked him like, hey, do you have children? And he said, no, this is also the reason I don't have children. And it was really like the first time I had like a one-on-one personal conversation with someone. Like, I know these thoughts exist, you know, like people, some people think this, but like that was really the first time I had personal contact with someone who actually saw the world like that. And it just, it really hit me. Like, I thought it was so sad in a way. And I also asked him like, you know, with all due respect, but like, does this mean you gave up? Like, is this just it? And then he said, yeah. I just, I don't know. I couldn't wrap my head around it. It's so far away from how I view the world. Like, I'm realistic in what's going on, but I'm, and that is not very positive, right? But I do have a positive outlook towards the future, but that's probably because I understand or see Bitcoin. I think that's the main reason, but I don't know. It's just hard to see that in other people, especially like our age, like same, you know, like a millennial age. Yeah, you're really building out your life, and then this is your outlook. I don't know, like, what do you see this too, or what are your thoughts there?
Well, I'm an optimist, and I would have never given up, but I have encountered people who are less optimistic than I am, and I think I'm more than average optimist, but I think it has to do more with people's individual traits and whether they adhere to a positive worldview. I know mankind is not doomed to fail as a product of this universe wanting to get to know itself through our eyes, and that's something that I see because I see what people choose to do, and I see the good more than the bad. But my father was a nihilist, and he tried to battle it by becoming a supporter of policies, and this is also why I'm so adamant about this. He truly believed in globalism for the better of mankind, and just coercion towards teaching people to make better decisions. And I knew this was wrong even before I understood what Bitcoin could do. But yeah, I will always have a positive view of the future, just because of how I see the world and what kind of person I am.
It's interesting when you share that. I think like that is already a pretty nihilistic thought, right? Like, teach other people how it should be done. It's actually very negative, but it does tie in with what I said before. Like, I don't think everyone can make the right decision, right, when it comes to drugs. So there, you know, if I reflect on myself, I think there's also a bit of that in there when I said it, kind of disguised as something that sounds caring. Interesting. I don't know. I'm just reflecting on that. But yeah, like I agree. I have to think about that for myself. But I agree with, you know, if you think like, oh, I know how this works, and I'm going to write and support policy to coerce other people into changing their behavior, like that sounds horrible, actually, because what gives other people, third parties, the authority to influence your life decisions, which is basically, what do you spend your time on, right? Or what do you spend your mind energy, your mental energy, mental energy on? But like, how do you think, like, how did we get here? I also wanted to ask you about, you know, like LSD experience, like insights into how you view life. You just mentioned about the universe. What you sent to me is the universe is a self-aware. It's self-aware through our perception. I love that. But like, how did that help you understand basically life, or what people do in their life?
Well, before I ever took LSD, I studied cognitive science and learning about the functions of our brain, and trying to understand what brain activity is, what consciousness is, what learning is, gave me a broad basis for what for understanding what LSD does to your mind. And what LSD then showed me was that actually everything is vibrations, and our brain perceives only vibrations, and enhancing this perception to become more sensitive to these vibrations and their resonances, their interference they create, to see all those patterns where interference is their synergy of waves, gave me the understanding that if this is all we can perceive, then that is that's the only thing we'll learn about our reality. Maybe you can have more insights about what our reality is, but the basis of it is that everything is vibrations, because that's all we can perceive. And one of the things that I concluded from that also is that if you want to know what time is, you have to understand how we perceive. And time isn't something that we perceive. We have memories, we have retention of everything that happens, and we do this chronologically. And this is through retention, and perceiving memories is actually the creating the perception of time.
Interesting. Yeah, I like to think about the concept of time, because everything was always now, right? Just like the memory at that moment when it happened was the now. But when you package it in a memory, you and like you said, you put it in time, I think it kind of distorts it also. Distorts. It also, in a sense, what are like the things that you took away from those experiences? Like how did you integrate them into your life or your current views on economics, for example, or your work?
I don't know how this integrates with economics necessarily, but
or like the human action that we talked about.
I think we have certain ideas about what facts are, and many of them aren't really facts at all. People just tend to believe a certain consensus, And people are susceptible to this, and they create a reality or a worldview that's based on this ideology that they build together. And I'm never going to stop there. I'm never going to accept a certain way things are, just because people who call themselves experts say that it is so. I will always want to know what the background is before this knowledge to want to exist in books. I'll always ask questions about it. I'll always want to scrutinize the ideas, and what I'm searching for is the bias behind it. Most ideas have a researcher's bias, and I think it's important for anyone who wants to understand anything to realize that everything is biased all the time, and you have to keep looking for this phenomenon in your work, in your thoughts. And LSD helps to pull you out of fixations of ideas and show you something that is completely different. For me, it really felt as though I was finally out of the fishbowl. I had been swimming around perfectly happy in this fishbowl, and I had my plants and my gravel, and I saw the glass, and I thought, oh, it's marvelous. There must be something out there. And I took LSD, and for the first time, I held the fishbowl in my hands. And this is also why I encourage people to be interested in this, even though that not everybody should do it. It's still something to be careful with. Most people don't really take it well when they have memory impairment, and this is something that people think is very, very scary most of the time. If you take a lot of LSD or psilocybin, there's a possibility that you become memory impaired and you lose all sense of time, and the trip just is perceived to last forever. Yeah. Because your function of memory fails, then your sense of time fails, and then you're stuck in a sort of a hole. And if you don't know yourself well enough, and you have some demons that have been haunting you, even though you've never really met them or acknowledged them, then you can be in for a very painful trip. But yeah, it ends, and people can get over those traumas and try again. And I think that most people will have a good time and really learn beautiful things about themselves, about reality, even if they just do it recreationally. I've never considered taking LSD as a recreational phenomenon. I've always done it with spirituality in mind, with self-development in mind. I've always set this intention, and I think setting in LSD, the way there, you can be conscious of what you get into and what circumstances you are under matters a lot. I think yeah. Paul Stamets talks a lot about that.
Yeah,
Michael Pollan. I read his book, and I think he summarized it well also.
Yeah, I love the fishbowl example. I think what you eventually learn is that you are not the subject, you are the observer watching the subject, basically. And that, you know, if you can look at the fishbowl, that you, what you think is you, right? Your body and your name and where you're from and all these things, you know, that is what we ascribe as to the you or what you are. But if you are the observer, the self, then you observe what is the subject. And then once you realize that, you know, I love the example of, you know, if the voice in your head is talking, then who is listening, right? You are not talking and listening at the same time. You are listening to the voice. You are the listener. You're the observer. But yeah, I agree. I think that takes work to kind of like get there and be open for that. But I was also thinking when you talked about consensus, right? Like the consensus is also in a sense the bias, right? If you agree mm-hmm. with a consensus without scrutinizing it in a way, right? Or researching it in a way or questioning it in a way, and you just follow it, which is the easiest thing to do, basically. Because, you know, when you scrutinize a consensus, you also scrutinize your own thoughts and beliefs about something. And that is hard for a lot of people.
Problem I have with the mechanist materialist paradigm that is currently the bias in science. It's just blinding scientists to open their eyes to what I think is a far more encompassing and understanding paradigm, which is the acoustic paradigm. I see myself and my central nervous system as an acoustic instrument. And with that, I have a paradigm that is extremely different, that diverges from the mechanistic paradigm that allows to understand certain phenomena. For example, a placebo effect is something that is you can't explain it with the mechanist paradigm, and also the integration of what string theory is trying to do, the integration of all physics laws into one encompassing theory. I think it's impossible from the mechanistic paradigm, and I think the problem with the mechanist paradigm is, for example, this is something that Rupert Sheldrake has written a lot about. He's dedicated his life to this, and I think it's beautiful the way he describes it. The mechanist paradigm is determining for science that nature itself and the laws of nature are fixed and can't evolve also. And just assuming this for whatever science discovers through research is just such a short-minded vision of what you're trying to accomplish. Because what you're trying to accomplish is not to rule out what you're going to find out. You need to have a framework that allows for more possibilities, because the you don't know what the outcome of your research is. You have to have an as open an eye as possible to also be able to recognize when you have discovered something.
I'm reading this
book by Gary Klein now, and he calls it stacks of ideas that lead to the discovery of new ideas. I kind of like that. In a sense, this is the rabbit hole I'm in now. I'm finding out more about Bitcoin mining, and I spoke to somebody who works in the power sector, and that person said that 20 gigawatts of power, which is the total mining capacity of the world of all of Bitcoin mining, is minute, she called it.
Compared to all the energy consumption.
Yeah. But not just that. Compared to what a typical energy company has in consumption. And at first it kind of scared me, but then I realized something that I now, with Gary Klein's idea of stacks, can sort of articulate better. Bitcoin is already a niche. There are very few people who understand Bitcoin, and once you do, you become adamant, and you start explaining it to people and to yourself better and better. But then there's Bitcoin mining, and that's the niche within the niche. And there are very few Bitcoiners who understand what an opportunity it is to be in mining, and also what kind of responsibility it brings. And I see it as the responsibility to revolutionize the energy sector, because the energy sector is one of the most wasteful industries, one of the most wasteful products of mankind ever. To just, because of low demand, just throw away a large percentage of your production, just because there's no incentive and no way to fix this inefficiency. And Bitcoin mining really does fix this inefficiency.
Yeah. What I love about this, sorry, like when you say about stacking ideas, I think it does come from kind of like first principle type thinking, or I think it's also a bit spiritual in a sense. Like for me, I at one point just adopted, I saw someone say, like, once you know that you don't know everything, right, then the world opens up, you know, it's and kind of like combined with, you know, everybody's winging it and nobody knows what they're doing. Like, that is really true, right? We are all trying to figure it out, whatever it is, right? Like however you define it. And I still try to wrap my head around what is that, right? Because it is actually,
it's also human action. It's something.
Yeah, but it's a hard decision. It's a hard decision, because if the world opens up, right, that's a lot of information. That's a lot of things to think about, right? That's a lot of things to consider, to constantly. I think it's also one of the things you sent to me, right? But like, you know, sometimes you have rational thoughts, you have ideas, but you're always open. Like, you're never married to them, because you know that you don't know everything, right? And you and I also, we enjoy doing that. It's enjoyable, right? And it gives us a certain energy and fulfillment in a sense. But lots of people are not like this. And not to criticize, not at all, but it's just like not a lot of people are like that. And these are the people that basically get abused, or they get put in this paradigm, right? Or they agree with the consensus, and then they, you know, never have to think again. Maybe that's a bit short-sighted, but like, they don't have to think for themselves, right? Other people think for them. And when you were talking about science, one of the things I had to think about, and I loved that, I heard Bernardo, you know, Bernardo Kastrup?
No.
I think he is a physicist, but also, like, I don't know if it's into string theory or whatever, but he studied like atoms, and eventually I heard an interview with him, but he ended up at same conclusion as that, you know, Eastern philosophers already ended up, you know, like everything has a consciousness, everything is conscious, etc. But he talked about like how science is conducted, that it's a bit flawed. Because, and he used this term, like, we follow observation is creation. And then he had the example of Darwin sitting on his boat, you know, he's observing, I don't know, certain types of birds, whatever, for 2 weeks, and he sees what they do. And then he creates a law, a nature law or a model, you know, like this
theory.
Theory. He talks about, you know, we know a lot of laws of nature, but we don't know why they exist like that. And the why they exist like that is a way more interesting question than just stating what you have observed, right? Like, okay, but why is it like that? I'm always, you know, I have this plant in the background, like I just got like a new leaf. I'm always fascinated, like, how does the plant know how it should grow? You know, like, it's weird. So I can observe the plant and how it grows, but it's still like, why, how was this plant programmed to grow like this? Like, how the, I don't know if you see it on the video, if people are watching, but it's like this Strelitzia big plant, and you have like a huge leaf, almost a meter, and it's all like all rolled up, and it grows And then, you know, it opens up and I'm with every leaf, I'm just fascinated, like, how does this work, right? And this is kind of what he talks about. Like, we can be like, oh, this plant grows like this. Yeah, but the question is why, you know? And the why is definitely not answered. And we don't know anything about the why. Not a lot, right? And well,
that's also because the why is from reason, and reason is it's a human phenomenon, and we don't know whether the universe itself also reasons. It's an assumption.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah. It's an assumption either way. So if the universe and all matter in the universe has purpose or not, if you decide either one is true for your work, then that sets it, and then you're limiting yourself. So I think a why question is
fair point.
Is interesting, but I think the if you notice that you can't really answer it truthfully, or if you can't really find something that's meaningful about asking the why question, the how question is also interesting. And just to understand the phenomenon from a different viewpoint instead of reason, just to be able to observe without evaluation, and to try to connect everything that is happening, and to understand the process from what it produces, and then later you can bring the why question back again, and then see so maybe the process was way longer than I thought, and now I might be able to answer the why question too.
Yeah, good point. I think what I tried to say was more like if we end on the consensus of, you know, this is a nature's law, whatever, then we also like stop thinking further, right? And I think that's what I liked in his point. It's just like, okay, you can identify how something works, but not why it works like that, right? So you cannot be so rigid as some people are about saying something like, this is how XYZ works, and that is just it, right? That cannot be the consensus, because there's something behind that as to the why. And you don't necessarily have to answer the why, I agree, but if you can agree that that stated truth or that stated consensus is not the final understanding, that's when you keep an open mind to keep exploring, you know, whatever could be different in not only information but also, you know, the actions that you can take in, you know, whatever context. But that is also something I wanted to ask you about. I like that you describe Bitcoin as human potential energy. Can you expand on the metaphor? Like, how can people understand what you mean with that?
Well, I heard somebody say Bitcoin is stored energy, and I thought, no, that's wrong, because you can take that literally. It is a human potential energy, is because that is exactly what it represents. You can exchange it for you can exchange it for somebody doing something for you. And you can describe what value that has for you, or somebody else can do it and can describe it. And then you find it as a payment. It becomes the representation of human energy. And I like to say it's human potential energy, because it's also all the energy that hasn't been spent yet. So you have in your with the Bitcoin you own, you have something that you can exchange for something that needs to happen in the future.
Yeah.
So it's a potential.
Well, it's basically what money should be.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I agree with it. I think it is when I own it, it's like human potential energy. I talked about this before, but like I once heard like everything you see around you, like literally everything you see, like costs energy to create or maintain, either by other people, you know, or I'm looking at a tree, you know, that's the sun, the water, etc., right? Like everything costs energy to create. But and so like that's kind of how I see, you know, with money, the exchange between two parties. If I do something for you and you give me, you know, quote unquote money in return, the energy that I expended, you know, in the exchange that that we have, well, you build houses before, right? So, you know, if you build a house and you use wood and you expend your time and energy and I pay you in, you know, whatever the money is, then it is stored energy, right? At that moment, I do see it as stored energy. Well, or it was my, you know, how do you say, what did you say? The human potential energy that I'm giving to you. So yeah, I like human potential energy or stored energy, but that is what it actually should be, right? Because then when you receive that money, and you want to spend it on something else, on anything else that costs energy to create or maintain, then that is what actually money should be, at least in my understanding, or, well, maybe it's opinion, but I think we agree on that. Right? Let's call it an opinion, but because definitely not everyone agrees in this world. But yeah, it's just that, right? It's exchanging energy all the time. And at the moment that we make an exchange, you say, you know, it takes 2 months to build a house, and these are the materials I'm going to use, etc. It's X amount of units of XYZ money. Then at that moment we have an equal exchange, and it should stay equal, right? Because you put all the energy in the house, and I should reward you in money that also represents that same amount of energy, and that it keeps that amount of energy towards the future for whenever you want to spend it on other human potential.
Yeah. That's why real estate isn't money and gold is. Gold doesn't have a upkeep, and a house has an upkeep.
Yeah.
So if you exchange money for a house, then you're not getting human potential energy. You get human spent energy.
Well, or your house leaked energy if something broke that was built before.
Yeah.
Then it kind of leaked energy, and you have to put that energy back, basically. Yeah. So how do you think, you know, your view on Bitcoin, how does it, what are the implications on how it can change the economy compared to how we use the money that we are forced to use now?
Well, I think what isn't being talked about enough is efficiency. And I want to change that. I want to start a mining company and talk about efficiency. Efficiency is one of my focal points in life. And I've noticed by having an efficiency mindset, I've been able to be more productive than other people. And I'm noticing with Bitcoin that there's less loss of energy because people understand the value when they transact it. And they understand that it takes something of quality to be to convince somebody to spend it on something. It isn't like the way fiat behaves. It's more like a flow. It's something that is constantly exchanged, and it doesn't allow for efficiency. It allows for a margin to be chased, a margin to fall off of production. I think Bitcoin is something that changes people's choices so that people become aware of whatever they're wasting, and especially time. So it starts with time, and then all other forms of energy that they have. So waste productivity is you're incentivized to use to recapture your waste, whether it's energy or things that have cost energy to produce. I think it's about understanding the mindset of efficiency, and I think once people really understand this, that just a whole new way of developing starts to exist for people, and I think this is the sort of next renaissance that Bitcoiners predict, and I think it's because of efficiency that people get the idea that things can be can be done better and more efficiently.
Yeah, I think how I think about it is the most inefficient thing people are doing now is trading their finite time or finite energy expenditure in time for a reward that can be created infinitely, right? The fact that when you have a job or a venture and you expend time and energy to get rewarded, when you come home and you understand that your reward is being devalued every year, that you have to mitigate that risk in some sense, so even take more risk, right, next to the risk you take with your job or your venture. The fact that you have to mitigate that is already a very inefficient thing. So you have to spend even more time and energy to protect time and energy that you already spent. You know, it's like just only that situation, I think, is something that I really think about and also want to be more vocal or coherent about, to show people like this is what you're already doing. And yeah, I agree with that. Like once you can be rewarded in the hardest money to ever exist, then you also have to do more. You have to put in more effort or be better at what you do to actually be eligible to receive that reward, right? Because the people that will pay you know that this is the hardest money to ever exist. And so they are looking for real value. So I think it will help people to actually discover what it is that they are meant to be contributing to society, you know, whatever that is, from being a doctor to baking bread or whatever, like, doesn't really matter. Everyone has his function, his or her function in society. I also believe that if we have a better reward for the human action, then the human action will be more efficient and more valuable because of that.
Yeah, people just tend to make choices, individual choices that lead to collective choices that create abundance and innovation. It's just when considering time, I see so many people just make the mistake of going for security, which is a false representation of efficiency. And what people do to negate what people do to battle their fears, to choose for what they see as security, for example, getting a job. For me, getting a job was never an option, because I understood that it was a complete sell-off of my time. And I understood the moment I was supposed to go work, become productive, that I had only two choices. One was do nothing and be happy with nothing, or become productive myself and embrace the insecurity that it gives. But the security that a job gives you is a false sense of security, because there's nothing secure about a job. Right now, billions of people have are so incorporated in their security system of working for a steady stream of income and having saved for a pension, but they don't know what keeps that into place, and they have no guarantees, because this system can collapse, and the result is that you've worked for nothing all your life. And even somebody at the end of their career, in the Netherlands, for example, if you die and you've saved all your career, then you've not only paid 30% to 50% taxes. So let's say you've been well off, and you've had a really good job in the Netherlands. You've been paying 50% taxes for all your career. That's 50% gone, and you have no say of what the government does with that money. And then 40% of that over for 40-year period is also gone because of inflation. And then your son or daughter inherits your savings, and then the state takes another 18%.
Yeah.
So whatever security you went for was immediately, and you could calculate this beforehand. You already know that if you start doing this, then you're wasting first 50, then 40, and then another 18% of your savings is going to be gone, and then you haven't even accounted for what might go wrong in your life that the money then would be spent on. So what are you giving your children? It's just a lot of wasted energy. And most parents who make this decision consciously out of a false sense of security are not only spending their own time, they're also spending the time they could spend on their kids. So this is also a conscious decision that I made. I wanted to be there for my son. He needs to have me in his life. He needs to have me around in his life. And I can't be gone 40 hours a week. I cannot. I have to be there to pick him up from school. I have maybe 25 hours to completely work on something, to engulf myself in. That's the time. That's the time he spent at school. That's the time I have to spend on work, stuff that I believe in. And that doesn't mean that I'm always in his face when he is free. No, but I want to be there. When he looks up and he has a question, I want him to find me. I want him to know where I am so that he can reach me.
Yeah.
And I think this time is what people are deprived of without them making any conscious decision about it. I see so many of my friends, they work, both parents work, and they're not even saving. They're just wage earners going paycheck to paycheck, and their kids are being raised by somebody else. And this is something I saw when I was a lot younger. I saw it before me. This is where it's going, and this is the thing that I need to battle. This is the thing that I need to solve for myself. I feel strong and affirmed that I was able to do it, even in a fiat economy. This is the thing that most investors talk about, or most entrepreneurs talk about. There is still we still have the ability to do something of value in this fiat economy and to create value and get a really good return for it. But that is productivity. And I think it takes a conscious decision to accept that any form of security that is given to you and not arranged by yourself is a forfeit, it's a false sense of security.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast, like I call it outsourcing your responsibility, basically, right? And that's, we do that in different ways. And of course, this podcast is about Bitcoin and we talk a lot about Bitcoin, but if you outsource your money, basically, and how you are rewarded for spending your time and energy, that is the main, like the root cause of everything that comes after that, right? Any decision in your life, where to live, build a family, and you know, a job, venture, whatever. That is what influences the rest of what people do in their life. So how do you see like the whole CBDC idea? You sent me, CBDCs are a ledger, that's it. No room for commercial banks, no distribution of power or consensus, no democracy. Like, how do you see this happening? We are, of course, in Europe. I see, at least in America, some states are, like, they have some pushback. Even Jerome Powell said something about no CBDC. So I think it's a different kind of battle over there. But in Europe, it feels like we are going that way. Although the ECB says this is not a savings vehicle, which I find interesting because that's one of the characteristics of money. But yeah, what are your ideas there?
So the difference between the Fed and the ECB is that the Fed doesn't have a plan for it yet. They're not open about it, at least. And the ECB is open about the CBDC. They're going forward with it. It's going to be in place, I think it's late 2026. They'll have the digital euro. Hmm. But like every shitcoin, if you don't solve the Bitcoin trilemma, then you're either going to end up with something that is centralized or something that is insecure, and there is only one balance to do this correctly, and that is the way Bitcoin behaves. So Bitcoin as a protocol is in perfect balance between scalability, decentralization, and security. And yeah, if you want to compromise for one of these traits to get to scale better, then you get Lightning, which has less security, or Liquid, which has less decentralization, or federated mints, which are less decentralized. So those are compromises that you can make, and compromises you can't make on the base layer. That's the whole point of having a base layer that is fixed. Yeah. And there's enough incentive to keep this way. And as long as the hash rate keeps going up, I have confidence that Bitcoin will manifest in this way. But a CBDC doesn't have a balanced answer to the Bitcoin trilemma. So the CBDC will always be just a central ledger. And if you understand what a central ledger is, that is something completely different from what commercial banks have. Commercial banks have accounts, and that's a decentralized ledger. It's not distributed decentralized. It's not in a beautiful way decentralized, but there is no central control over what amount is in which account. And this is also the reason why it's so good for fraud. There are many ways to have your bookkeeping, because it's only double entry bookkeeping, to be done creatively, so that your bookkeeping doesn't have to match my bookkeeping. So if we keep sending each other invoices with fiat, there's no centralized way to control who owns what. I can have a different bookkeeping, and that sort of needs to match. And the Dutch tax authority will accept discrepancies. And they will accept it because they have no control over it. Yeah. And this is something that a CBDC can solve. And this is also why the central bank, the ECB, wants this. And then another consequence of this is, if they have a central ledger and all the accounts are with the ECB, then what is a commercial bank? It doesn't need to exist anymore. So what are they getting rid of? And I say they, central banks, what are central banks getting rid of at the moment? That's what I think is happening right now with the higher rates. They're getting rid of commercial banks, and they're not going to bail out the commercial banks. And that's why I'm also not conclusive about what the Fed is doing. I think they have a new secret mandate, and that is to get to a point where they have their new world order, where they have their new money for the world, which is a CBDC, a central ledger controlled by one single authority. And the problem that happens is that this is just another policy. And yeah. What I think is laughable about it is, if you do this and Bitcoin doesn't exist, then you still don't have a foolproof way to treat something like the exchange of gold. There will always be a search for people to deal with the economic circumstances that they wished they had a better store of value or a better means of exchange to solve the situation they're in. And if you present people with a true worthless money, like a CBDC, the first people to notice are the entrepreneurs. And they're going to stop asking for that as a payment.
Yes.
And there is no way to keep this economy rolling with a CBDC. There's just, and I say this with certainty, out of conviction. Maybe this is an ideology, but I think it isn't. I think based on empirical evidence of studying money systems of the past, we can see that there has never been the installment of a non-backed currency. And a currency doesn't need intrinsic value. It just needs to be backed by something when installed. And in the case of Bitcoin, it is proof of work, and also proof of verification.
Yeah,
value.
Well, it's just a provable,
verifiable.
In general.
Yeah, so it has value propositions that match its value, and.
Exactly.
And a CBDC will not be able to do that for itself. The dollar at the moment is decoupled from oil for a large part, and it's in transition to becoming worthless. And the only thing that keeps the dollar of any value as a means of exchange is confidence. So at the moment,
Well,
yeah, it's also just that people walk around with bills in their pocket or a number on their bank account, and they know it's redeemable for what the price tag is. This is confidence. The people have confidence that their value is stored over at least a long enough time for them to spend it. But if this changes, then the house of cards falls, and if you then try to bill in the people with a CBDC to come in to be the savior of the economy with a CBDC, it's only a matter of time that the people don't see that the ball is actually not rolling anymore.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a disaster. So if they do this, I think it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, I said fear because it's hard to accept that the money is not real, right? That what you see in your bank account is not actually there. That's kind of why I said feared. But yeah, it's still that trust, right? But the verifiability, I think, is the main part. And as you said, I like that about, you know, CBDC is just another policy, but you cannot verify it. Like, it's again all talk, no walk, right? Where in Bitcoin, it's the verifiability that at least gives you more information on making a decision if you should trust it for, you know, your option to save your energy in. I think that's it. Like, it is advertised in a certain way, but you can also verify it for yourself, right? And every other form or type of money, same as the CBDCs, it's only advertised, right? When you see people talk about it, it's like, it's going to be more inclusive. It's just, you know, cash, but digital. It's just, it's all talk. It's there's no options to actually verify it and make a conscious choice whether you should adopt it or not. And I think that is what Bitcoin constantly shows. I mean, it's the same with the halving, right? The halving is just like, hey, this is the monetary policy as advertised. See, it's still working. I think that is what it shows, yeah. Right? And that, every four years it does.
And that doesn't need marketing. Whereas a CBDC is going to be heavily marketed into the market. It needs to be installed.
Well, if you have to, I told my son this, like we were sitting in the car and he heard a commercial. He's like, is it what they say? Is it true what they say? I said, well, if you have to make advertisement for it, probably not. You know, that's not totally true, but I love to instill that. Well, to round it up, because I have to pick him up from school. You know, I ask everyone, you know, what is a core belief you will never let go? And you already sent me the following. I don't have a belief, or I try to get rid of beliefs. Ideology is becoming redundant. I have plausible outcomes and crazy ideas, and I can switch between all that without being married to any of it. I think we talked about this a lot already, but I do want to ask you, there must be something you adhere to or practice that you find valuable in your life.
I think I could answer that with my faith in humans. Even though I can see that humans have good in them, I see it in the way people look at each other and the way people treat each other. If they have abundance, they will treat each other really nicely. And I think if I have an ideology, it is my faith in mankind.
Great ending. Thanks, man. Love that we finally recorded something. I will link to your X profile, Nostr profile, in the show notes so people can follow you and your thoughts. And I think I see you in a few days. We go for lunch.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Thank awesome, you, man. Too, for talking to me.
Awesome, man. Talk soon.
See ya.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bramk, that's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.